to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with data protection people. My name is Ollie Rear, but you know that by now. And as ever, I am joined for the purposes of this intro by Mr. Miles Dacres. Hello, Miles.
Afternoon, Ollie. How are you?
I am very pleased. I'm very happy. Our last session of 2021, and it was excellent. Well, I thought anyway, but that's... I'm probably biased. What do you think?
No, I definitely agree with you. It's been a great year of episodes, great year of content. So it was nice to wrap it all up in that session there.
Absolutely. We never thought we'd get this far, I don't think. It's very much started out as a bit of a pet project, really, wasn't it, in the lockdowns to try and, you know, keep people engaged and look at how it's grown. You know, it's quite phenomenal, and we're extremely grateful to our little, or not so little anymore, community.
Not so little at all, Ollie. I think if you consider that this time last year we actually had less than 100 subscribers, and as we approach the end of the year we're upwards of 800 subscribers and 3,000 listeners regularly, on 3,000 unique listeners online as well. So it's really, really snowballed over the last year, hasn't it?
It's quite incredible, and hopefully it continues to do so in the new year, because we will absolutely be back in the new year. There's no question of that. Certain people on that session just then have in fact prohibited us from ever cancelling it. Said, don't you dare. So we were planning to be back anyway. But yeah, we've got some great events, haven't we, for the new year lined up.
We do. We'll have one similar to this week on the 7th of January, where we look back at the last year, 2021, of data protection, and look forward into 2022 as well, and look at what changes the new year might bring and what you need to prepare yourself for. So that will be a great session too to kick off the year.
Excellent. Thanks for letting me know. I wasn't aware, so I can prepare for that now.
Yeah.
But sounds good. Great way to kick off the year. We're very excited for it. It's been truly excellent. Last few bits of news, I think between now and then, the new DPP website should launch, right, Miles? I think that's probably a reasonable estimate.
All fingers crossed. Yeah, it'll be ready and working for the first of the year. We're about 99% there now, I think.
Excellent. So we've been teasing it for a few weeks, so hopefully you're all excited over that. We certainly are. Over the holiday period, if you do have any issues, we still have a skeleton crew available, as Phil says, towards the end of the session, so if you have got any issues or questions over that period, then do reach out, support@dataprotectionpeople.com. We're still about, effectively, but until then, I will leave you in the very capable hands of Mr. Phil Brining and just myself this week, but hope you enjoy, and we'll catch you all in the new year. Let's get stuck in, Phil. I mean, there's loads to talk about this week. We thought we'd struggle, but actually there's mountains. There's a few news items. I don't know where you want to start. We've got the stuff about the Human Rights Act that you've put in here, the reforms to that, which is quite interesting. There's also a couple of fines I wanted to talk about. Entirely up to you as to where you want to start, though.
Well, let's start with the fines. I mean, there might be other people on the session that the Human Rights Act's reform will affect more than others. For us, it's definitely not the central theme of what we do. You know, it underpins what we do, of course, but it's not a central theme, is it? We don't. So again, people might have a much more illuminating, discussion about that than we're going to have, Ollie. But let's start with the fines, because we all understand the fines.
We know about fines. Well, I've got two here, one of which has very much grabbed headlines over last week, which is the fine that's been handed down to Grindr. There's some interesting things in that to talk about. But before that, there's another one that I found which I thought was quite interesting, and I didn't really see as much noise about it, so I thought it was worth raising. And it's a fine which the Dutch Data Protection Authority have handed down. And it's a fine of about 2.7 million euros, so a reasonably hefty fine. But there's a few particularly interesting aspects to this. So the fine basically is relating to The Ministry of Finance, or one of the tax authorities, more specifically in the Netherlands, that had been processing the dual nationality status of all applicants to a childcare benefit. And basically, the DPA found that there was no reason for them to handle that information as part of that. It's simply not needed. They also found that they'd been handling that information as part of combating organised fraud, in inverted commas, and as part of the automatic classification of the tax authority's risk system. So there's a lot going on there. It's pretty intrusive, and there's not really that much of a need to have the dual nationality aspect involved. So it's understandable why they've handed down the fine, but one of the things I thought was particularly interesting is that they have not handed down the fine to the tax authority themselves. They've handed it down specifically to the Minister of Finance individually, because the Minister of Finance is deemed to be responsible for that overall processing, which I just thought was an interesting little
aspect. I wonder what's the basis of that then?
Well, as far as I could tell, I mean, I was working out of a translated copy of the Dutch findings, and they basically said literally, you as the finance minister are responsible for the tax authorities processing. It's under your control, under your remit, and therefore we're going to hold you personally responsible.
So that's a bit like our section. Is it 198, 199 of the Data Protection Act?
But that's
just for offences, isn't it? So only directors and officers are liable for offences, which are defined in the DPA. That is interesting. It's a big fine for an individual, isn't it?
It's a big, big fine for an individual, which is why I was confused at first. I thought 2.7 million seems absurd for an individual. Then I wondered maybe whether it was against the post within the government, and therefore maybe it's something like they'll take out our future earnings for anyone in that post, maybe. But I don't know. It seemed to be worded such as, you know, personally, you are responsible for this. So if anyone's got a better understanding of it, and is, you know, please do dive in. But I just thought it was worth raising.
I haven't looked at that, but I will have to go and look at that now, see if I come to the same conclusion.
Mm. So the other one, obviously, is, as Mark is asking about in the chat, is this Grindr fine bill.
Yes.
Is interesting for a number of reasons. So it's a big fine. I think it's, I've not got the number here, but I think it's about 8 million, is it? Something to that effect.
Can't remember, to be honest. Steph's put a link to the Norwegian, the Datistil, I can't pronounce that right. The Norwegian Data Protection Commissioner.
Yes.
So we're on, Ollie. Sorry, stopped you mid-flow.
No, that's absolutely fine. Don't you worry. Well, the fine itself, there's a couple of interesting points that I picked out when I was reading up on this that I'll come back to. But the fine in and of itself basically relates to the validity of consent, right? Because as far as I can understand it, when you open up this app, you're basically prompted to agree to the terms and conditions and privacy policy. And as part of that, they've bundled in a consent for user data to be shared with third-party marketing platforms. However, the data shared as part of the marketing exercise includes things like GPS location, IP address, advertiser ID, age, gender, and the fact that the user is on Grindr in the first place. And this is one of the things that they've picked up on, is the fact that simply by virtue of being on Grindr, that is effectively information relating to someone's sexual orientation, right? Because it's an app targeted primarily at what they call, what was the term they use? Those in a sexual minority is the quote they use. But, you know, obviously if you're on Grindr, then there's an implication that comes with that. And that is deemed to be data relating to sexual orientation, which I think is a good interpretation.
Well, it's not. I'm struggling. My computer's really struggling. But I think the specific wording is that isn't it first later that it doesn't say relates to. I can't remember exactly what the GDPR says about this, but it uses broader language, doesn't it? That my mind's gone blank and my computer's letting me down. What does it say in Article 9?
It says information
that identifies, or no, I can't remember exactly what it says. But it's broad, you know, so it doesn't have to be, you know, the sexual orientation of this person is X. I think the fact that they're on Grindr would be indicative of someone's sexual orientation. I probably would agree with that interpretation.
Data concerning a natural person's sex life or sexual orientation is the wording, Phil. So concerning.
Okay, right. Yeah.
So that is sufficiently broad.
Yes. Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's often quite interesting when you talk to people about this, because each of those groupings, and you've got it there in front of you, has got a different descriptor, hasn't it? So the rigid philosophical belief, different to data concerning health, which is different to what you said about sexual orientation, and the biometric stuff again is different again, isn't it? So if you read it properly, you know, which everyone I'm sure has, then the nuances are there within it, but a lot of people don't read it in that way, and they just think, you know, oh, this type of information, you know, is special category. It not necessarily is. It just depends on whether it fits in with those, you know, the way it's being drafted.
And this is one of the things what Steph's pointing out in the chat, which is that basically the Norwegian DPA found that one of the aggravating factors is that both Grindr and their marketing partners are basically making a profit out of this unlawful sharing of information on quite an intrusive level. So it is interesting. Well, two of the points I picked out, and I wanted your sort of thoughts on this.
It's just under 5.5 million sterling, 65 million krona.
Okay, right. One of the points I picked out, actually, which sort of instantly piqued my interest, was the fact that it was the Norwegian DPA. Because I sort of thought, well, why are the Norwegian DPA picking up this particular, you know, enforcement action? Mm. And actually, it's interesting to see if you read the, because it's provided directly in English, the rationale behind it. And they talk about the fact that effectively, because they are a US company, I think, and they don't have a main establishment in the EU, they have a representative in Ireland. But by virtue of that, what they are doing is not considered to be cross-border processing, and therefore the cooperation mechanism under, it's like Article 56, I think, that's not engaged. So the Norwegian DPA are competent to take up enforcement action relating to complaints made by Norwegian citizens, which was the case here. Mm. I mean, in practice, you know, most of you might go, well, yeah, obviously that's how it works, but I just often find it interesting to see it written out like that and actually, you know, work through that process. The other point I thought was interesting was that in their judgment themselves, they call it a deterrent fine. They're sort of very clear about the fact that this is, you know, they're sending a message, they're firing a shot across the bow, so to speak. And make an example of them. So just some interesting things in there. I don't know if there's anything else that you've picked out from it, Phil.
No, to be honest, I didn't look in detail. I noticed the points you'd made, and you know, nothing particularly else to add, to be honest.
Yeah, Steph's saying that it's worth reading as a case study of lawyers arguing. There is an old phrase that if you can't argue on the facts, argue on the law, and if you can't argue on the law, argue on the facts. Yes, quite. I mean, it is an genuinely interesting read. Yeah, I enjoyed it. There's another piece of enforcement action, actually, that's just, I only spotted this morning, which Petra's put in the chat there, which is relating to one of the German authorities, I think the Bavarian one, maybe, but I might be wrong on that. But they've basically, as far as I understand it, and Petra, please do come on and talk about it if you want to. As far as I understand it, they've basically ruled that European companies cannot rely on American cookie management platforms because that is deemed to be an international transfer, as far as I understand it. So they've sort of said that it's not justifiable, or you'd have to go through the process of justifying it anyway, so you can't rely on these platforms. I think that's what I got from it, but someone please do correct me on that. But potentially quite
even if it's stored out in the EU. Well, that was definitely worth looking at, isn't it, that one?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's been the interpretation, hasn't it, particularly post-Schrems too, is that even if you're storing data in the EU, if you're an American provider, it sort of doesn't really matter because obviously
no, it doesn't apply.
Yeah. So very interesting. We'll have to see how that develops. Potentially shake up a lot of things on that front.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. So any other enforcement action or news you wanted to cover, Phil?
Well, in terms of news, there was quite a few. I noticed during the week the proposed reform of the Human Rights Act, and I did look through the executive summary for that, and I skimmed through the 580-page report, which was quite heavy going, to be honest. And I came to the conclusion that there were some changes, but a lot of it seemed to be political, I think, the impact of the court in Strasbourg and things of that nature. But the UK's already got a right of veto, hasn't it, over, and can argue that a ruling isn't consistent with British values. So, I'm not sure why it requires codifying into a revision of the Human Rights Act. But again, as I said at the outset, people might be much closer to the HRA than I am. And of course, it only affects public authorities. So, the majority of organisations, aren't obliged to comply with it anyway. Certainly commercial organisations.
I very much agree with you on the seems politically motivated front. It feels like, I think I put this in the notes for our session, it feels like exactly what Oliver Darden was doing with his DCMS reforms. It's, Brexit's gone through, now we're going to make our own rules. We're going to make a big noise about it. But as far as I can tell, that independent report that you mentioned, the 580 pages one, effectively the outcome of it is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, as far as I can tell.
There's a bit more, it talks about education, educating people about the rights, and so that it starts off in that vein, and it makes some suggested changes to your judicial system. And the comment I've read, it doesn't seem to be, particularly, materially different, if I'm being honest. But anyway, as I say, I'm definitely not an HRA expert.
No, and neither am I. From what I could tell, you mentioned a lot of it's to do with, I think they talk a lot about handling the spurious challenges to asylum seekers being removed. I think that's one of the things that they want
to change, which is
sort of, a bit of a coincidence that sort of times quite nicely with the Nationality and Borders Bill going through, which is all to do with stripping dual citizens of their nationality and potentially making them stateless. But that's a separate topic. We're straying outside of data protection now.
Now, did you see that Sainsbury's had a ransomware attack, or rather their payroll provider did?
I did not. Please tell me about it.
Payroll provider called Kronos, and they got hit by a ransomware attack, I think, yesterday. Okay. So Sainsbury's payroll systems basically are down. They've got 150,000 employees. They said that it won't affect their ability to pay before Christmas. But again, it just shows the vulnerability, doesn't it, if you're contracting out these critical services, as many organisations, including us, do, then you're at the mercy of the provider's security and, what due diligence has one done on these organizations, what level of due diligence is required in those circumstances. I mean, ransomware is different from a leak, isn't it? Because it's kind of making the data unavailable rather than exposing it. But that was quite interesting to see, because American companies, they're providers of payroll services quite a lot, like Honda, for instance, also use Kronos, and there's quite a lot of large companies use them.
It's interesting that, because, Jasmine was asking me from our support desk this morning a question, or not necessarily asking me the question, but sort of asking me to confirm. But she apparently had been having a bit of an argument with one of our clients' suppliers, who effectively were a data centre, a storage provider for all of their data. And they were categorically pushing back and saying, we are not a data processor. And Jasmine sort of said, well, how much ammo can you give me to argue? Because clearly they absolutely are a data processor. They're storing personal data on behalf of control.
Are they? So software as a service, the ICO says, is a processor. But I'm not sure a data center necessarily is. They're providing a physical security. Again, I've been through this week. In the context of PCIDSS, so the client's got a fantastic, I have to say, data centre, which I went to inspect. But the PCIDSS requires a clause in the contract for the service provider to acknowledge they're responsible for security, and he wasn't there. So I said, well, it needs to be there, otherwise you're not compliant. And they said, oh, that's going to cause all sorts of problems, getting a contract variation. So I said, well, just get them to write a side letter. I'll write it if you want what it needs to say and get them to sign it. Anyway, that's what they did. Dead easy to do. But this was a really good, fantastic data center in Manchester. But they're responsible for physical security, for monitoring the internal aisles of the data center and all of those things. But that's the extent of what they do. So they're not processing any data. They're just simply providing a facility and maintaining it securely.
I see what you mean, but do you not sort of also think that if the storage fails fundamentally and you have a loss of availability there, that at a certain point
who's providing the storage? If you've got your own servers in your racks and you're responsible for them, then no, it's not their job, is it? If you've got a contract with them to do hot swaps and all that type of stuff, then maybe. But I don't think the ICO's view is that if you're doing the physical changing of a hard disk, that you're actually processing data. So I don't think, it's different software as a service. Like we're on the Teams platform here, they're providing everything, aren't they? The software and the facility and the backup and the security. But if you're simply providing a secure room for somebody else to put their stuff, I'm not sure I wouldn't have said you're a processor in that respect. I mean, it's one extreme and the other, isn't it? Software as a service is definitely considered to be a processor, mm-hmm. but to what extent does, right, here's a server in this building, where at what point does it become, right, you're now a processor? I think you'd have to go up the scale quite a long way.
Well, fair enough.
I don't know what anyone else thinks. I mean, happy to stand corrected, but if it's simply a room to provide somebody else's, for you to host your own equipment in, I would have said you're the controller of that equipment.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. I'll have to go away and think about it.
We'd have to think what makes them a processor. What processing are they undertaking on behalf of the processing? You'd say, well, processing includes the storage of data, but they're not storing the data, unless you think. Then the UK government, is storing the data in the UK, because they they own the land, or somebody owns the land.
Yeah, we'll have to see. I think you're right. It depends how far along the scale, I suppose. Anyway, moving swiftly on, because I don't want to turn this into rambling about this.
I don't know if you saw in the news also. This was also interesting, and I really love to get a copy of this. So Porsche, your favourite car company, have decided
Since when is it my favourite car company?
I thought you had a collection of vintage Porsches, or is that somebody else I know? Or maybe I've dreamt it. It's not you.
Sounds like you dreamt it. It's not me.
That's future you. So Porsche have said they want to accelerate their data-driven business model, but they've prioritised privacy of customers in that strategy. They've got a four-pronged privacy and data digital business strategy, which I kind of loved. I've scoured the internet, can't find it. I'm going to have to reach out to Porsche and ask if it's possible they would share the bones of it. But, they've said that this is going to be competitive advantage for them, that not only will the vehicles, be top notch, but also the way that their users of the vehicles interface with it and the information that's collected about the use of the vehicles will be, created with privacy in mind, but privacy by design and by default. So again, it should be in there, but it was just interesting that they'd made this public announcement, that they're going to, have this corporate strategy 2030, which has got these four key principles in them, because it's the first time I've seen a company of that nature kind of say, well, our core strategic strands is privacy.
Interesting, very interesting. I've got a couple other bits here. Steph mentions the Cabinet Office, the fine they got in relation to the New Year's Honours list. which I didn't dive into. I did see briefly. Chastain is a good example of the. I think we mentioned it, but again, I've not really dived into it properly. So, but apparently, a good example of the need for technical and organisational measures and training, which I will take your word for, Steph. There's another bit in the chat I want to pick up on.
Yep, carry on. Crack on. Yeah, no, carry on.
Okay.
I was going to go off down a totally abstract, random direction, so you carry on. Ignore
Save
me.
Save that for later. yes, the other bit I want to pick up on is this bit that Rick's put in the chat. Rick, you've been waiting very patiently after I teed you up, so please could you come on and tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, no problem. Hi, guys. Yeah, so this is just the US, it's called the Clarifying Lawful Overseas Use of Data Act. So it spells out cloud. And it's a piece of US legislation that provides the same powers to the US organizations as the FISA and exec orders that, our Mr. Schrems used for scrapping the Safe Harbor and Privacy Shield for lawful transfers. So in my head, this has got a potential to cause problems, concerns with public and private organizations using things like Google, Amazon Web Services, Azure, in that at the minute, if we're using these platforms, we're choosing to geolocate them in the UK or the EU, then affording us the rights that we should be giving data subjects. But then if then this, this act overrides and then gives the same powers to those data centers overseas. So in effect, giving the US extraterritorial scope on their legislation, the same as we have with GDPR. So it then gives us a possible additional work for doing almost international data transfer, assessments for information that we're storing here in the UK. So, and this is huge implications because, the police, the government, probably you guys, everyone's using Office 365 and US services. So it's a real, to me, it seems like a scary one in that we could either comply with GDPR or comply with the US legislation, and that the two seem to be exclusive to each other. I thought I'd pass it on and see if anyone's got any thoughts.
Yeah, I think I do vaguely remember reading about the Cloud Act a while ago. I mean, broadly, as you say, it's the same situation as FISA, really. It's powers for US law enforcement to go and request data if it's in the control of US providers effectively. But I mean, the thing is with this, because I've looked into it in the past in doing sort of transfer risk assessments for using US providers for my clients. And the thing is, I mean, I know it's not the point, but really the risks posed by these pieces of statute is so incredibly remote. I mean, how often are the FBI going to come knocking because they want your data specifically? Again, I know that's not the point, but a degree of pragmatism, I think, would possibly go a long way in relation to a lot of this. I don't know if maybe I'm just being naive on that front, but Phil, feel free to correct me.
No, I'm just wondering if you were on Dave's soapbox.
No, wait. I'm not. No, that's away while he's on leave. He's taken that with him on holiday.
Oh, has he? Right.
Yeah.
Well, I have to
transparency, Ollie, that some of this stuff isn't really, we're saying national security level. Some things you're thinking, it would be incredibly remote. But then, as you learn in the past of people like Snowden, then, there could be no limit because they can put a, non-disclosure or, a silencing order on the companies that they're requesting the data from. We'd have no idea what information they're accessing.
That's very true. And I suppose ultimately the key is that, as soon as that you let them take an inch or take a mile on this sort of thing and gradually eroding away,
yeah,
a lot of protections in this way is always cause for concern, which, links nicely to the point we mentioned before about the Human Rights Act, I suppose. It's part of the reason it's worrying, you start to erode these things and before you know it, you look back and, it's all been weakened or diluted. Anyway, on a more upbeat note...
Thank
on
you.
A more upbeat note, Phil, you put a basic timeline here in my notes about key events from the year.
I thought that was worth discussing, trying to cast our memories back. But I don't know if you saw the Log4j vulnerability exposed. I think it was Friday. As I say, I got on a call at 9 o'clock on Monday morning with one of my, that was doing this PCI assessment for, and I said, you know, what are you aware about this log forwarder? This, we had a meeting on it Saturday morning. We've changed all our code and it's all sorted. So I thought, well, that's efficient. That's a Java logging, code really, it's a logging code basically, but a lot of software applications use it, and Minecraft is one of those that uses it. So they were, these techies were most concerned about that having its impact on their Minecraft empires. there's probably technical people on the call that are more aware of that and its implications than we are, but that was another one that I noticed in the news. I don't know if you have seen, Ollie, I looked at the ICO's website this morning. I'm going to go off on a tangent. I'm going to try and share my screen, because this is really, I think this is quite good, actually. This is an interactive thing on the ICO's website. So you can have a look at these are security incidents. You can have a look at it. It's got by sector. Yeah, and it's a great little tool, though, just having a look at it, you know, where all the personal data breaches incident reporting incidents came from, you know, by category. Again, there's a lot of these. Like, I hope it's big enough to see, but, you know, data emailed to incorrect recipient, data posted or faxed to incorrect recipient, non-cyber events. So, you know, phishing, this is all, again, we know this, human weaknesses, isn't it? Loss or theft of paperwork, you know, failure to use BCC, failure to redact. You know, this is still here. You know, these are the big blocks, aren't they? Of vulnerabilities, you know, internal human vulnerabilities. This is quite an interesting way of looking at it then. So the 25,000 or 26,000 incidents reported, you know, how many were cyber, non-cyber, and then, you know, you can have a look at it, you know, by sector, and then you can have a look at it the other way around, you know, by sector, and what types of incidents occurred in each sector, basically. But I think it's a great tool, really good interactive tool on the ICS website.
Yeah, have you got a link to that?
Yeah, let me just see if I do that. It's here. I'll put it in here, security incidents trends. I'll put it in the thing, yes. I think it's good. Moving things and pretty things on the website that are relevant are quite good, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting just to have a little...
Yeah, Power BI, you're quite right, Tony. Toby, it is, it's saying it's using Microsoft Power BI. It's really good. I think it's a good execution. Sorry, Rick, I put the link in there. That's the link to it. If you can, maybe I've got to click that button there. That's it there. They've done that. Right, Ollie, you were saying, yeah, I just thought, you know, we're at the, you know, end of the year. It's gone exceedingly fast. It must be a factor of age, because it seems to be going faster and faster. And I just thought it's worth looking back in review at, you know, some of the things that have happened this year, key things maybe, you know, and then maybe as we're at this point in the year, you know, considering what might be topics going forward. So, you know, you forget, or I'd forgotten, that it was, you know, the start of the year where the Brexit transition period ended. And then, you know, we were off and running, weren't we? In January, you know, so yeah. You know, what are the key things that happened in January? We had, to celebrate International Data Privacy Day, we did an 8-hour one of these, a podcast, didn't we, which was really good fun. I thoroughly enjoyed doing that. I can't remember what else happened in January, if there was any, you know, major breaches or guidance coming out. But, I mean, there's a lot of turbulence, wasn't there, with the, you know, the Brexit transition period ended. What was your recollection of January? Anybody else, for that matter? You know, what did we do in January as a kind of a profession? What were the key things?
I think one of the things you hit on there is really the my key memory from that time, at least the first sort of quarter, at least of the year, turbulence. Particularly obviously, as you say, Brexit, would we get adequacy or not? You know, potentially new rules around transfers, etc. So I remember there being a huge amount of, you know, actions that we had to complete with some of my clients that we ended up just having to put off for a while, just while the dust settled, really. You know, a lot of work around, even sometimes things as simple as reviewing privacy information, because we don't know, you know, what mechanisms we're going to be able to use to transfer data internationally where we do. So, yeah, very, very turbulent time, as you say.
I don't know if anybody else has got anything to throw in about their recollections of January. I mean, I couldn't really think of what kind of, yeah, that's the poorest thing. As I said, I'd love to see the bones of that part of the strategy, but I'm not sure that this slows out to us. Just checking the chat. The next significant thing for me, Ollie, in the year, I mean, I'm sure there was lots of things happening in Feb, March, April, but in June, you know, we had the EU-UK adequacy, I think officially ratified, didn't we? And the new standard contractual clauses for international transfers. So that was, again, a big month. There was a lot of build up to that. You know, a lot of speculation, will we, won't we, and all that type of stuff. But then when it actually happened, you know, in June, in the middle of the year, you know, again, it seems a long time ago, doesn't it? But it was only 6 months ago.
Quite, yeah.
So that was it. Again, anybody else, if we're skipping over things, important things, you know, do throw it in. August, you know, we had the DCMS proposals to reform privacy law. Again, that took us by surprise, you know. And there's a lot of looking over that. September, the Children's Code came into effect. Again, I'm not sure how many of the people on here it affects, but that came into effect at the start of September. October was an enormous data breach. Twitch, 5 billion records. That's a lot of records. That was a big breach. November, we had the Google, Lloyd v. Google determination. Elizabeth Denham's left now as the ICO, so we're in a state of being managed interim by the deputy ICO. And December, you know, I'm not sure, you know, we've had a few things. You know, we're also, this year, we've had the proposed white paper for social housing. I can't remember exactly when that was published, but it's quite interesting because it's been a year of change, hasn't it? A lot of stuff coming through, you know, which is, you know, building on or changing, you know, some of the rules we're working with.
Absolutely. I think, even though we do enjoy this sort of thing, it would be nice for a slightly quieter 2022, possibly, in terms of changes. So we actually get to grips with a few things and... you know, get back to brass tacks, because you say so much change. It's it's difficult to keep up at points.
So again, if anybody's got anything to, you know, significant things, significant fines, or there was a new data sharing code of practice. I'm jumping about now, aren't I? Which was October, wasn't it? That came into effect.
Yes.
So there's been quite a few things. So what are you expecting next year, Ollie, then, in terms of, you know, the industry? Where do you think are going to be the key bits to look at?
I am not entirely certain, but before I get into that, Tracy's got a hand up. Do you want to jump in, Tracy?
Yes. It was I just put something in about the NHS guidance. So this year, the NHS updated their guide to retention of records. So it's kind of a sporadic document that comes out. So last time it was 2019, before that it was 2016. So we'd had quite a long period of time, and they tend to change into sort of chunky bits because we're a hospice. We tend to follow NHS guidance on those areas. So an example is a few years ago we had, so in 2016, counselling records were 20 years, then they were increased to 30 years and then dropped back down again. So we kind of try and follow the code as far as we can. But this year they seem to have increased the HR staffing records to the staff member's 75th birthday.
Oh, right.
So if you have a staff member that is an agency nurse and maybe he's contracted to you for bank, works with you for 6 months and then goes, to then have to keep a summary record of that individual until they're 75, I wonder, does anybody know what the rationale? I'm going to email NHS England and just see if I can find out the rationale, but it just seems really onerous. And
it does, doesn't it?
It does.
It doesn't seem justifiable, really, does it?
I mean, obviously I can understand, so occupational health records, I'm wondering if it's because of occupational disease, for example, because they do mention in there people that might be exposed to radiation. So obviously there's the X-ray departments and stuff like that. But it does say staff records and occupational health summary, 75th birthday.
Yeah, that's it, full stop,
no explanation.
Yeah, you'd think they'd narrow it down to certain categories of jobs or, you know, locations within facilities, you know, so, you know, are you going to keep those records for all the cleaning and the catering staff and, you know, anybody else that's in a, you know, an ancillary position? I mean, cleaners might end up going in those radiation areas, I suppose, but interesting. Well, it'd be interesting what you get back from them.
Yeah, so I'll update when if I get some feedback. So I'm going to email them today because obviously I'm needing to update our policy. But already my HR department are jumping up and down and saying that's not tenable. So especially pulling out summary records, we tend to keep the whole to keep the majority of the file, because by the time you've spent time pulling things out, deciding what needs to be kept, etc. But we've been doing 15 years because of our insurance requirement. Mm. So, yeah. Okay, I will update if anybody knows the answer.
Yeah,
put it
in the
chat.
Is it possible that it's connected to
the asbestos cases? Because there were a couple of cases recently where they were trying to find out who worked in buildings which were contaminated with asbestos. And because people were deleting the data too early, you couldn't really find out who worked 30 years ago in these kind of buildings. And maybe they used that because we don't know yet if there's any chemicals or anything in buildings that might in the future turns out to be harmful, that they're using that as an example why they need to keep these data that long, because at 75 you would then know if there are any health implications.
Yeah, potentially. And we did wonder, I know the 15 years was right, was around sort of potential sex offences coming out following the sort of Savile inquiry, etc. So that's why our insurers came in with the 15 year. But yeah, OK, I'll explore a bit more. And thank you for the piece, Joe, that you've put in as well. So that is the current one. So I'm looking at it online as we speak. So that's the 2021 guidance. So, OK, thank you.
Thanks. It's very broad there. I mean, I might be wrong here. I thought it was like 50 years retention for records of asbestos testing. But what we're talking about here is HR records, aren't we? Correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like we're talking about HR records in general for all classes of employee.
Whereas that's all it says. It just says staff record.
Yeah. It's kind of like, well, let's just keep everything in case we might need it in the future.
So 50 years, you're right, is occupational health reports where people have been under health surveillance because of the role that they've had. So that is 50 year. But yeah, the other one is just says staff record. So very ambiguous. Okay.
So you could have a 74-year-old employee who then, you know, you've got asbestos testing records for that you then have to keep for another 50 years.
Yeah.
Do you? I don't know. But anyway, that's...
Or as I say, bank staff might work with you from when they're 18, 6 months, then go. You've got to then retain that till their 75th birthday. It's, Okay, thanks, everybody.
Interesting. We'll have a read of that. That'd be good.
Yeah, difficult, isn't it? As Sobey said, it very much feels like a bit of if in doubt, hold on to it, which is very much what we're told not to do under the storage limitation principle and all the guidance that goes with the GDPR. No, interesting. I was intently paying attention, but I sometimes like to let people have the floor to discuss these topics. We've only got about 10 minutes left, Phil. You asked me a second ago about, well, not a second ago, previously, about where you think we're going to go next year, what we might see. You've put some things down here on the notes, so I'm going to bounce off of those if that's all right, because I haven't got my own suggestions that I've thought of yet. But you've put down here more work on international transfers. I think absolutely. I completely agree with you on that. There's still a lot of clarity needed in that area. International transfers are still so difficult. I tend to agree with you on that front. And then the other one being litigation and mass privacy claims, which we've spoken about a lot recently. And
do you think that's been put to bed now, or do you think there's going to be further work on that?
I don't think it has been put to bed. I think there's, you know, even in the wake of, you know, Lloyd v. Google and some of these cases, and we mentioned a couple of weeks back the Warren DSG Retail Limited, which is a big one. I don't think it has been put to bed. I think there's still significant scope for these claims to be brought. I think quite rightly so. But I do think that organisations have got more ammunition than they ever have to bat a lot of these more spurious claims, shall we say, back. You know, we're still seeing a continued increase in support of clients being confronted with these letters saying, you know, I've suffered a very, very minor breach as a result of your organisation's practices, and therefore I'm entitled to a payout. So we are seeing it. You know, the law firms that are, let's be honest, trying to make a buck off the back of this, they're not interested in seeing it slow down. So they're very much still, flooring it on this type of action. So no, I don't think we will see it slow down significantly. I don't know. You may feel otherwise, but
no, I don't know. I think that you're still trying to pull. I think it will gradually. Well, I think it will gradually peter out as the the weight of the judgments, you know, moves, you know, the goalposts into a more obvious position. And there are still some unanswered questions, aren't there? Ah, Steph's disagreeing. That's good.
Yes, do please disagree with us, Steph. Do you want to come on, Steph, or if you're available to?
Just reading it now.
Give me a second. I've had a shave this morning. I'm not ready to come on screen, so apologies. My point there really is, if you look at the grinder thing I've been going through, I do a lot of work in behavioural targeting, and so it's quite key. There's a lot of things going on there. And they point out that this case is very complex, and most people couldn't understand it, but now it's been found to be, or it's been ruled against by a DPA, it now opens up the ability for individuals to say, well, actually, there has been some transgression. And it's really interesting. I'd recommend anyone read the case notes. You've got things such as Grindr's lawyers arguing that somebody putting their details on Grindr made that data public, and therefore it was exempt under Article 9 from a special category. And it's a real sort of, there's a lawyer's piece here, and there's a, from a perspective of trust, a brand piece. They put forward this argument, and you can see this now coming back out from people saying, well, actually, when I went onto Grindr, I assumed that it was confidential. And I get frustrated sometimes with arguing about the law. We sometimes look at liability. We don't often have the ability to say, well, actually, I don't know. We'll find out. It seems to be this natural, you know. And I partly have this. I sometimes pick you up on this ambulance chasing thing. I do think there are ambulance chasers, but I do think sometimes transparency is good. And whilst you don't want a SARS deluge, actually getting a SAR come through, or a degree of SARS, is potentially to say, well, actually, our transparency obviously isn't good enough for our data subjects. Therefore, should we be looking at our SARS information we put out to improve it, to reduce the amount of SARS? You know, I think sometimes we look at it the wrong way.
No, I very much agree with you on that front. I know you and I were exchanging messages a couple of weeks ago about this. I think you're spot on that last point in particular, which is that all too often, I think SARS complaints, etc., come through and they're treated as, you know, a burden, quick, let's deal with them, get them out. And there's very little reflection, introspection about maybe why these are actually coming in. I'm not saying that's the case in all businesses. There are definitely businesses who are very good at, or organisations are very good at looking at these things and saying, well, clearly this person didn't understand what we were going to do, and that reflects poorly on us, as you quite rightly say, from a transparency perspective. But there is a tendency, you're right, to sort of go, quick, let's get rid of it, let's deal with it, and you know, we won't worry too much about why these are coming in, and just hope they stop effectively. So I completely agree with you on that point. It's something to bear in mind.
But I think also what will happen is that you've got, there's a lot more awareness, and sorry, I keep going back to the grinder. It's a really interesting, I think it's a very well written response. A lot of things are put forward. There's an argument in there that Grindr shouldn't be fined upon revenue. They should be fined upon EBITDA, effectively profit, and saying, well, actually, no, you shouldn't, because that actually potentially encourages bad behaviour. You know, if you're, you're not making profit, you're trying to gain as much data as you can do. And, you know, if you're not fined on revenue, that would enable that. It's a really interesting read. Sorry if, yeah. If you've got some time this weekend, I'd
I'm going to definitely print it. I have to print it. I'm going to print it off. I'm going to read through it. I'm going to comment it out. Definitely, it does look like it'd be a right, you know, really good thing to pour over.
I've got my own version of it. I'll send it to you, Phil, so you don't have to download it. But it's got my sort of elements of this is what I look at it.
Okay, it. That'd be really useful to see, Steph. Thank you. Yeah, yeah.
No problem.
Yeah, yeah. Whether it, you know, go on, golly.
I was just going to say, I think you're absolutely spot on. I've not really had a chance to properly grapple with it yet, but even the sort of bits that I picked out and read really sort of did pique my interest. Very interesting. Sorry for what you're going to say. Something.
I was going to say, but as to whether it results in, you know, the data subjects pursuing Grindr for a damages claim, don't know. I mean, don't know where would they do that in Norway. I don't know the law in Norway sufficiently well to you know. But in the UK, the courts have been saying, well, if there's no, you know, demonstrable damage, and security is not one of those torts, is it? Did we say that before? Then I'm not sure how strong a case it would have.
Well, the Grindr thing, it does use the phrase that it's the tort was the loss of control of data, and it's special category data, and that's the big argument. So, you know, whether it comes to anything is. Needs to be seen, but they've effectively highlighted that there's discretions in it, and it's quite interesting because they limit it to a period of time. They put in a new consent management platform, and the authority said, we're not even going to comment on that. We're going to look at what you did.
Yeah, I saw that. Period.
And they also used the, you know, you had plenty of time to put this in place. GDPR was published in 2016.
The fine is definitely fair enough, isn't it? But the data was disclosed to advertisers, so I'm not sure, you know, and then they obviously got targeted advertising, the data subject. So I'm not sure where you'd kind of say where's the harm. It's not like the database was leaked and it's now in the public domain. This is like 30 or 40 advertising companies who've, you know, been disclosed. The data's been disclosed to them unlawfully, and they have processed it unlawfully. But where's the harm, you know? I'm not sure I can see it yet, but I shall read through it to the weekend as you suggest, and see what we think.
I'll ping it to you.
All right, thank you. Yeah. I had an interesting conversation with UCAS, the United Kingdom Accreditation Service, is it? Earlier in the week, so I was talking about certification schemes and codes of conduct, and they said that there's a few in the pipeline. So again, I think that next year there might be a few more certification schemes come out, and I was talking to them about the possibility of writing a very broad kind of certification. You know, excuse my naivety, but I said, look, yeah, I've done work with invested people in the past, and people like the plaque on the wall, so you know what I foresee is, you know, a certification scheme whereby you go and audit an organization. You say, yeah, we think you're compliant or can demonstrate compliance with UK GDPR. Here's a plaque to put on your wall for 3 years, you know. And so they were saying that there's nothing like that in the pipeline, but there are other certifications, you know, very sectoral specific. So I had a really good chat with them. I said I'd mull over everything they'd said and pick it up with them in the new year. But Paul Bailey came back to us yesterday about the housing code of conduct. Again, we've been in consultation with the industry and with the ICO, and the ICO have now said they want to have a meeting in January just to kind of give us some more feedback on what they think. It's all been positive so far, and we have to sort out the monitoring body. That's one of the key things we've got to do. So that's what one of the things I'm talking to UCAS about, how you know, who might be available to do the monitoring for that code of conduct, and you know, what would be the barriers to setting up a monitoring organisation. And, you know, maybe representatives from the industry as a separate company, and take it forward in that way. So it's interesting that what they were saying is there's a few more in the pipeline, because only three codes of conduct currently available, one of which is a private code and two are public codes, so other people can assess against them. But the children's code, we had somebody on that the other week, didn't we, talking about that, and that's a private code that only they are licensed to assess against, but there's others in the pipeline.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's going to be, as you say, a big focus for the year. I'm just, as I say, conscious of time, as I always am. A bit of a bore on that front, but we have hit an hour. It is 9:30 now. Some people are already diving off. So on that front, Phil, any closing thoughts for not only this session, but the year's our final session of 2021?
No, I mean, I enjoy these sessions. I think they're good. You know, we enjoy doing them. I hope people enjoy listening to them. You know, and it's great to get other perspectives, you know, people jumping on, you know, with a different perspective or with a more appropriate use case. So we only know what we know, you know, but one of the things we're trying to do is support the community of privacy practitioners, you know, and, encourage dialogue, not just with us, but, you know, among the whole, you know, or everybody on here, you know, everyone could know each other, should know each other, could talk to each other, you know, some in the same industries, which are kind of facilitate that. So I think that you know, we enjoy doing them. They're probably good to do. I think we're going to continue with them next year, aren't we? That's our plan.
I think so.
It's been a year of change. It's been a good year. You know, it's been a year of change. We're still dealing with this COVID. I think there'll be more kind of high level data sharing cross border. You know, that's been driven by COVID, hasn't it? I think there'll be more of that next year. And I think a realization that, you know, the GDPR doesn't say no to everything. I was talking to someone the other day and they said, oh, you know, I'm the chair of this, the Tees Valley Youth Orchestra. And, you know, we're not allowed to get the email addresses from the parents of the kids in youth orchestra because of GDPR. I said, that is absolute nonsense. How do people still have such a lack of understanding of what the law is, including the government? You read that DCMS right paper and they're really having to go, aren't they? The law says it doesn't really, does it? It's not that prescriptive, actually. So I'm just hoping that, you know, next year is a year of enlightenment and people, you know, are getting, you know, more comfortable with it and, you know, starting to fold into their processing activities, you know, properly structured thorough audits and the concepts of privacy by design and by default, rather than just focusing on the same stuff, you know, that we've been, it's like groundhog day into some of it, you know, the same stuff, same errors coming up.
Yeah, all I'd say for is be careful. I can see a soapbox romping into view as you as you ramp up there. But no, very much agree. That in particular on your last one, I'm completely with you on that. So on that note, I think we should probably call it a day. Thank you to everyone for attending. Thank you ever so much for your support over the year. It's been absolutely fantastic. We're so pleased to see that you enjoy these sessions because, as Phil said, we very much enjoy running them. We absolutely are set on doing more in the new year. We've got no intention to slow down. We've got plenty of events already that we're penciling in. We're very much looking forward to those, but the GDPR radios will keep coming. So thank you all very much for your time, your efforts, your attention. Thank you, Phil, for your contributions on all of these sessions, but especially today, whilst our very own David Holmes is away sunning himself on the soapbox, mayhaps, I don't know. But yes, thank you all ever so much. We wish you all a very happy holiday season from us all at DPP, and look forward to seeing you all in the new year.
Just a quick last note that we are we have a skeleton crew on over the Christmas period. So if you are a client and you do have a situation you need to discuss, if you fire an email into support@dataprotectionpeople.com, or if you're not a customer and you've got an issue you want to discuss, you know, fire it through. And we've got a skeleton crew, which actually is Kathy and Dave Holmes. They're both manning the support desk on a rotational basis over the Christmas period. So we're back, all of us are back on the 4th of Jan, but you know, we are not closing the office during the Christmas period. We've got a support function still operational.
Absolutely, very much so.
And so thank you, Ollie, as well. Nobody's thanked you, but you know, you did a marvellous job hosting them. It was like patting ourselves on the back. That means it's time to go, doesn't it?
It does, I think so. So let's call it a day. Thank you, Phil. Thank you, everyone in attendance. Thank you, Miles, actually. We've not thanked Miles yet, and all the sterling work that he does on this. I'll see you, Miles, very shortly to record the intro to this, which we do offer. But thank you, everyone, and we will see you in the new year.
Yes, yeah. Indeed.
Thank you all, and I hope you have a good Christmas and New Year.
Thank you very much. Oh,
likewise.
Right, good stuff. Bye, everybody.